Hello and welcome to the Three Donkeys podcast. My name is Tyler Bielman. I'm here with Scaff Elias.
Hello.
And Richard Garfield.
Hi.
And we're not being very successful at this intro news part of the podcast because there just doesn't seem to be much news. So, but I did note as I was doing my research that
maybe we should switch topics away from gaming or anything to do with the gaming industry.
Do you have what do you want to talk about? She-mails or?
Actually, I really don't. Interesting suggestion, but no.
No, we're going to stick with gaming, I think.
Why, do you have some interesting news, new news along those lines from this last week from your life?
Or games along those lines.
She-mail games?
Yeah.
Now, let's get back on topic. I have nothing to say. So GDC was this week, and I've never been to GDC. You guys, did you?
Oh, wow.
Did you
count yourself lucky, my friend.
So you guys, you weren't there this year, but you've gone in the past?
Yeah.
Any stories?
Well, we don't go there anymore, so that's...
Yeah, we went there a few times. We helped do some workshops on game design. We also gave some talks. And did some schmoozing. Schmoozing and talks is what goes on at GDC. GDC stands for, what is it, Game Developers Conference?
Yeah.
It used to have an acronym, GDDCG?
CDG. There used to be an extra GD or C in it, and it was very confusing to me.
Yeah.
So I'm happy that it's down to three letters. Really, it is interesting to go, especially the first time you go. And then it probably gets uninteresting after a while you're still listening to a lot of really bad and boring talks. And then probably becomes interesting again once you learn to discriminate and sort of understand what talks you should be going to and what talks you shouldn't be going to. But there's this middle ground, you know, like your third or fourth time at GDC might be a really bad time.
And did you ever give a really boring talk at GDC?
No, but we were almost, this is 10 years ago. I would say virtually kicked out because we gave our talk with an overhead projector and writing on transparencies.
Wow.
Yeah, it was old school. They had no idea what to do with us.
Yeah, they
was that an intentional choice? Were you guys trying to be retro because you were tabletop guys and... Or was it just that's the technology you knew how to use?
Well, we came from academics, and then we went to the paper game industry and just didn't use these newfangled,
PowerPoint
stuff.
Yeah. Well, not only that, it is actually far better than PowerPoint because don't laugh. because you can draw in real time, and when people ask questions, if you're drawing diagrams and interesting diagrams, when people ask questions, you can change the drawing, redo it, point things out that you can't really do in PowerPoint.
There's all sorts of things you can do in PowerPoint that you can't do in PowerPoint. Like I was at a math talk and Conway didn't have an eraser for his thing and he ran out of transparencies, so he licked it. And so that's like spitting in the face of 300 mathematicians. Very impressive. You can't do that with PowerPoint.
You can't. You can't embed YouTube videos into a transparency, but, you know, I guess that's just...
You can make flip transparencies. We used to do that where you... Yeah, that's hard to do, though.
Yeah, fair enough.
I've never done a flip transparency, gotta say.
I just remember when I was a teacher and I would use transparencies, like cleaning them off was just ridiculous. You can't...
Tongue. You lick.
Yeah, I never did. I guess I missed the point of that story.
Yep.
So but seriously, did you've given talks at GDCs? Tell me, about that.
Well, one of the reasons I stopped going is because they're so draconian in preparation for talk. They're very concerned with the quality. And so, you know, 6 months in advance, you got to send them the topic and then you got to send them preliminary drafts. And it was just felt like I was jumping through a lot of hoops. But I gave a couple talks and I thought they were well received on, collectability of digital objects and
I gave some
topics like that.
Metagame stuff, metagame design or something like that. We've given informal talks in the bars afterward.
Yeah? What's your drink of choice, by the way?
My drink of choice?
Yeah.
It just varies, you know, based upon
mood. You're pretty cheap. I mean, anybody who knows you knows you're a pretty cheap guy. Do you drink cheap?
Not when it comes to drinks.
That's what I'm asking.
Anyone that knows me knows I'm not cheap in that regard, unless I'm in Eastern Europe.
So you've
so helped. In the bar, we at one point Scaff nearly got lynched. He got nearly run out of the bar because he was bad mouthing a classic game.
Yeah, the theme of the conference a couple years back, and by a couple I think we mean 10, was how to make games broader in the marketplace.
Congratulations, by the way.
Oh, because they've become broader?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, it was all that conference.
They have, although it's really interesting when you look at the numbers. I mean, I think games sort of, most people don't realize this, but games, I guess, apex in terms of their breadth was probably back in 1980 or so, and it's been all downhill from there. If you look at the number of people that played arcade games and had Atari home video game systems, as a percentage, it was actually a much bigger percentage of the economy and population than play today.
So what did you say at this conference?
We just sort of said that you know, these.
So people, you're in the bar.
We're in the bar, and we're talking about.
You're drunk on expensive liquor, is what I'm get taken away from the story.
Actually, not at all. But everyone else was, and thank goodness, because a lot of people probably forget that I was the one. They have a vague memory of some crazy person bad mouthing Zork, which I did, and I mean it was like I was in the middle of a bunch of hungry sharks. I mean, they got really mad when I started bad-mouthing Zork. And the point of it was not really to bad-mouth Zork, I mean, but so much as to bad-mouth the people that enjoyed Zork.
So the people in the room specifically.
Yeah, yeah, really, really sort of all of them at once. I thought it was sort of a given. It's like, okay, well, Zork, you know, was good for its time, and that's all we could do because we didn't know how to do anything, so we did Zork. And and we had nothing to do, so we played Zork. And it was always just sort of a general assumption of mine that that, you know, if you could, you would say, yeah, this isn't really very good. I mean, we're not going to get people in the real world, real people, non-computer game designers, people with lives, however you want to say it, to play a game like Zork. And I sort of went off on how ridiculously stupid Zork was, and typing in general is probably pretty bad. I mean, that's already a bad start. When you're typing for a game, and so
you don't think it was just fate that like Solitaire won out over Zork in the offices?
No, there's really
like
not.
I've never seen any secretaries playing Zork.
Yeah, I think there's I think there's the thing about Zork is. It's terrible. It's a terrible game. It's a terrible game. There's no real decisions in it. You walk around. You know, who wants to say north? You can't go north. West, you can't go west. South, you can't go south. East, you walk into another room. East, you can't go east. South, you can't go. What? I mean, what's going on there? Why do people want to play this? You see a bell. You know, I ring the bell. I don't understand what you mean. I hit the bell. I don't understand what you mean. I ring the bell. I don't understand what you mean. I jangle the bell. I don't understand what you mean. I clang the bell. A shiny tone rings out. I mean, this is not the game that's going to make games go broad. And I think that's pretty obvious to sober people anyway, which most of the people in the room weren't. But a lot of people really enjoyed it. In fact, I didn't know this, but the guy standing right behind me designed like Zork 4 or something like that. And so,
Zork 4, the bell clanging.
And I got a lot of flack from a lot of different people.
So yep. Did you exit bar, run street, open car, drive away?
I went south.
Yeah.
he went south, and then he couldn't. He went north, and then he couldn't. And he went west, and he went through the door. He was in the lobby then.
Yeah, and anyway, that was just that sums up a lot of the computer game industry. There's a lot of people that that are, you know, nerds, maybe.
And take their shit very, very seriously. And
they take it very seriously, but they like different kinds of things than the average person likes.
Well, people take very seriously the games they were brought up on, and the people in the industry at that time were brought up on Zork and things like that. And 10 years later, you know, we're probably got another generation that's not so attached to Zork, but they're going to be attached to whatever, Mortal Kombat.
Right. And part of it is, I think if you were a computer nerd when Zork first came out, you probably had the kind of mind where you could see the possibilities of where this could go. And a lot of what you liked about Zork was what you were putting into it, especially these people that eventually became computer game designers. Like, hey, this is cool because I think I can do this and this and this. And they started seeing, you know, Diablo 2 in Zork or whatever. But the regular person, you know, the average person just doesn't. So, you know, when you make it broad, you've got to understand exactly what and how much of Zork is horrible.
And were you guys, I mean, you guys made your bones in the tabletop games and you're doing some video game stuff now. Were there video game, what were the board games when you were growing up that were heavy duty influences on you guys? What did you play when you were kids? Because there weren't video games when you were kids, presumably.
Dungeons and Dragons, certainly. Yeah. I played a wide variety of just board games, card games, you know, Hearts, Risk, Stratego. And there are a lot of games. Like, I played a lot of hobby games, and there's a lot of them that have a soft place in my heart. I've got a soft place in my heart for them. A warm place in my heart for them.
Soft and warm.
Soft and warm. Anyway, but I've had to confront many irrational attachments where afterwards I realized, you know, that game actually wasn't that great. I would not play that these days. And I'm sure it's the same thing that's facing the Zork players.
Yeah, for me, I played, other than like hex-based military games, I played zero hobby games. And those are games that back then they defined hobby games in certain circles or maybe just period. And today you don't even call those things hobby games if they even exist anymore. But 90% of the games I played were Monopoly and Risk and Pitch, which is a card game.
Oh, I played Pitch.
Yeah.
I played Pitch in college. Drunk Pitch. A lot of drunk Pitch.
Yeah.
So we started this off talking about GDC, and you know, one trend that people were talking about a lot, at least a couple months ago, is sort of a topic on a lot of news sites and blogs, was that there are a lot of transliterations of tabletop board games into the digital environment. I think the ones that get a lot of attention are things like Settlers and Carcassonne that have made their way onto the Xbox Live network. What do you guys think of those games? Have you played them? How do you think the experience is different in a digital environment than on the tabletop?
I think there's a lot of interesting potential for moving onto a digital environment with those with transliterations of board games. It's like a gaming crack in some ways because the games can move so quickly because all the busy work has been taken out. There's no shuffling. All the setup and everything else is done automatically. And the fact that you can, at its best, find a game 24 hours a day is crazy. It's like nothing I've ever experienced before. But at its worst, you know, it's like most of the games on the Xbox, most of the board games on the Xbox, you go try to find a game and there's nobody there. And you've got to work just as hard to get together with your friends if you actually want to play. Because if you just go in cold and look for a game of Lost Cities, you're going to be waiting around a long time because nobody's there. And then you won't be there. And so the next time somebody, the critical mass isn't there, so people just stop going.
Well, which is crazy because the critical mass is there in sort of a general sense. I mean, there's a lot of people online at any one time on the Xbox that wants to play these games. And Richard has a great analogy for how the matching system on a lot of these games works on Xbox. As he points out, it's not the number of games that there are, because at his house there's a large number of games. They're just organized a little bit better.
Yeah, no, I've got a large set of games in my house, and the thing is, we just as a group choose the games. When playing on Xbox, it's kind of like I had made a different room for every game, and I release my guests randomly, and then they run from room to room trying to find a game. So they go, I run to the acquire room. Ah, nobody here. And then I run to the Monopoly room. Ooh, there's one person here, but two-person Monopoly sucks. So then I run into the into the Dominion room, and maybe somebody's there camped out. Okay, we'll play two-person Dominion. You know, but there's 10 people running around. They could find the game of their choice. So it seems like there ought to be some way in which instead of going to these rooms blindly, everybody's in one room and they've listed all their preferences, and so you can see how many people in this one lobby want to play any particular game. Then it's working in many ways better than my house works. You would hope the computer, the online network, would work better than my game room.
There's just some sort of algorithm. I've got my top 6 games, maybe 10 games listed, and the computer just picks, you know, matches. Oh, well, these people are willing to play Dominion.
It could be an order of preference, too. I mean, it's my first preference is to play Settlers. Right. My second preference is Carcassonne, and so.
Right. And the thing is, to match that up optimally is probably a really impossible problem mathematically, but you're not really interested in that. You're just any match on the list, you know, and it's a go, and you'll be getting a lot more games being sent off.
So is the environment different when it's the broad internet, when you're talking about websites that do games, you know, portals for games and player matching?
Well, the internet's just got so many more players it's the same in principle, but in practice, you can find you can go into even small games and find players. With Xbox, you don't have the same the same audience. It's a much smaller audience, and then a lot of that audience is focused on the big name releases. They're not playing Ticket to Ride online. They're playing
Halo,
Call of Duty, World at War, Nazi Zombies.
Yeah,
not that's what I've been doing obsessively the last.
Yeah. So the very big games on Xbox are fine, because you can find enough people, you know, for your top, you know, like your AAA titles. Of course, none of those are going to be Xbox Live things, but you'll always find stuff there. It also works well if you have a lot of friends and you log on, you see what your friends are playing in session-based games, and I just joined Call of Duty because my friend's playing Call of Duty, or I join Halo because my friend's playing Halo. You know, under those sorts of circumstances, it works. But
it doesn't
work for the small games, and it doesn't work for people with small groups of friends, and it doesn't work for people that don't want to play the sort of join in the middle of a session game.
Yeah. So what online portals, internet wise? I mean, if you guys messed around with Facebook stuff, are there sites that you think do it well?
Yeah, Facebook has some game apps which are good, but I think the sort of the best site for just straight board games is Brett Spielveld, Brett Spielveld. And they do a lot of the Dominion, Settlers of Catan, just the big Euro games and American style Euro style American games. They've got a lot of games to choose from, and they do a pretty good job. They quickly implement stuff. There's some other sites like that, but that's the best I know.
Do you know if they do an open source coding thing, or does the community help build the apps?
I don't know. I would suspect they do, but I don't know. I haven't looked into it.
Well, let's get to mechanically how these things work a little bit. You know, turn-based tabletop games have a lot of different things going on. People are taking turns. I know that when you move to an online environment, people have less patience and things can go faster or slower.
And that's going to depend on the person. Like when Richard said before, sometimes the amount of busy work you have to do and the time it takes for a person to take their turn can go way down online. And so if you are a game addict with limited social skills, like Richard is, then that's great for you. Sorry, Richard. Richard actually has excellent social skills, but
he's a terrible game player.
But Tyler doesn't.
My guests don't, so I'm just as happy not to talk to them. So
what happens is, you're going to have lower attendance next game night, or at least you would if anyone listened to the podcast. What's going on for most people is when they play these hobby games, they're not really as much interested in the game, or at least say the bottom half of the group is not as much interested in the game as they are in just kind of hanging out with their friends and talking. So it turns out that that while for a hardcore game player, when everybody's turn goes down from 10 minutes to 9 minutes, that's a good thing. But for the person who's there for social interaction purposes, there really is no downtime between turns because Richard's taking his turn, I'm talking and joking. And then online, I'm not doing that. So it goes from zero downtime on the turns to, you know, if there's five players, then when it's not my turn, you know, 4 times 9 minutes, 36 minutes of downtime between turns. That's a huge, huge.
How much downtime?
A lot.
36?
A lot.
For
9 minute turns.
That's a good point though. Is the downtime to me as a game player seems to go down for a lot of games, but when you've got a lot of people playing a game, if it's a turn-based game where you're taking turns, it's way worse online because you are, you know, maybe your turns go down from 3 to 1 minute online, but you're still waiting for 5 minutes as opposed to having 15 minutes of chat.
Right.
And when I've played poker online, the better applications, and it still staggers me that not every application does this, lets you pre-hash your turn, you know, a fair amount so that if you know you're going to check or you know you're going to fold, you can sort of pre-hash your turn. And yes, you need to undo that if somebody behaves in an unexpected manner ahead of you. But you know, poker is certainly a game that's made the jump from the tabletop to the online in a pretty successful manner.
Well, I think a lot of people play poker for reasons, let's say, other than social interaction and other than having fun at playing the game. So, yeah. You know, as soon as you bring money into the equation, then that for at least a certain section of the people really changes what the mechanics are of why they're playing and how much they're willing to put up with downtime. Although most of the people that we know that play online poker have several boards up at once.
That's true.
There's way less downtime in online poker than there is in real poker. It goes much slower in real life. But yeah, for somebody who's playing for enjoyment, there's still a problem if I'm sitting at a poker table at a casino or my pal's house, it's like even at a casino, I might be chatting with the people at the table or something like that. But online, it's just relentless. It can be very boring. I like to play games, and I still would try to play multiple tables to try to decrease the tedium. Get to the exciting parts, because the exciting parts were no longer as much watching the other people or talking with them, because it's, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. So for poker, if I'm the type of person that goes to a casino and I'm just playing for money and I'm not really talking with people, online poker is great. But is it going to replace the weekly poker night with the guys where you're sitting and jawing? No, probably not. I'm not going to stop doing that to play online poker, but I might stop going to the casino so that I can play, you know, 4 or 5 hands of poker all simultaneously.
And without naming any names, since the law became enacted that you can't play for money online in Washington State, which I think has to be directly attributable to the fact that we have so many tribal casinos around.
Just casinos in general,
tribal. But do you know anybody who has stopped playing money games online because of the legislation?
Yeah.
Really?
No, we know several people that have stopped playing, and we know one person that moved, actually.
I actually don't know. I don't know anybody who's continued playing. Probably some have, but they don't talk about it. Certainly, everybody I know who played stopped because, it just wasn't worth it.
Other than the people that moved that they could keep playing.
Wow, that's amazing. So other games that, you know, have been classic games have been translated into digital environments, and some of those get adjusted and changed. I remember, do you guys remember Archon from back in the day?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't really chess.
Part chess, part arcade, yeah.
I loved me some Archon back in the day, and like on the Commodore 64 or whatever. And what are some other translations or transliterations of board games into different environments that you guys like?
Well, there's...
I wouldn't call Archon a transliteration.
Or it's not even really a translation. It's sort of... But it is taking some elements of board games interesting way.
I grant your premise. It's not a transliteration. But I really liked it.
And you wanted to talk about it.
And I wanted to talk about Archon. Shout out to Archon.
Magic. You know, there's Magic Online.
Tell me about this Magic that you refer to. Magic the Gathering?
Yeah, it's a trading card game.
Yeah,
nerds play it.
Gotcha.
It was a long journey getting Magic put onto computer. What we wanted was actually a transliteration as much as possible of the paper game. And we found that really hard to get publishers behind. They wanted to make online worlds where you walked around and dueled other people. And
they wanted to add walking into Magic. That was the main thing.
Yeah, you guys, what are you talking about? That sounds awesome.
And they wanted to make it so when you played a game, you won cards from some outside source. And they wanted to have new cards that did things that only worked online. Whereas what we wanted was, you know, you go on, you buy cards, you make decks, and you play games where you draft cards.
Yeah, I fought many a battle as at different points the contact person with our licensee, trying to get the primary version being the multiplayer. I will say that some people there, the higher up people there, really were behind that. Gilman Louie in particular, and so it really did seem like eventually we were going to get there, and then of course licenses run out and et cetera, et cetera. But it was incredibly difficult to convince the people actually implementing the game that they didn't want, you know, that Magic really didn't need a lot of walking in it.
Yeah, I haven't played Magic Online in.
I don't understand. How are you going to get new cards? You have to walk to the store.
Yeah, that's
it's crazy. And you were saying that Brett Spielveld had something like that in the beginning.
Oh, Brett
too,
Spielveld.
Right?
I don't know what it is today. It's been improving constantly. But at the very beginning, you had to walk to the different towns, and if you wanted to play a game of Settlers of Catan, you had to go into the Catan room and see if anybody was there. It was almost literally like I was talking about spreading the games into these rooms and wandering randomly, although it was even worse because they had many Catan rooms.
Just thinking about variants quickly, you guys ever play Steve Jackson's Nightmare Chess? It was a card deck that you put on near the chessboard and had special powers. And wasn't, I mean, it stopped being chess pretty quickly. Do you feel like there are environments or applications that make board games more interesting or better when you put them into a digital environment?
Well, there's all sorts of things you can do on computer which you can't in paper or is burdensome in paper. And so seeing people explore that is always fun. A really good example of that is Kung Fu Chess, where it's real-time chess. I can move my pieces at the same time you can, but once I move my pieces, it deactivates for a little while. And so that takes... Everything. I mean, it's got a lot of the strategy of chess, but it's something completely new at the same time. Of course, you couldn't really do that in any easy way with a board game.
Although the idea of time pressure in chess has been around forever. It's now on a very tactical level.
Right. It's time pressure where each piece has its own little timer and moves at a particular rate. It's quite different. But even games which are traditionally on paper are sometimes much, much easier to play online. Like there's a chess variant called Blitzkrieg where I play black, you play white, but we don't get to see each other's pieces. So that means that I only have I have a board with my pieces. You're in another room with the board with your pieces. Then there's another room with a moderator who has the entire game going at the same time. So this is a real undertaking to set this up and to play, but it's a lot of fun on a computer. It's trivial.
So, and it's not, forgive me, I don't know the variant. It's not that you can never see the other person's pieces, I'm assuming. I'm assuming it's for some period of time or some area of the battlefield, you can't.
No, there's different ways of running it, but the way I'm familiar with, you actually never see the pieces. What you do is deduce where they are, and you do that by making moves, and then the moderator will say, you can't move there. And so you figure out there's a piece in between, and then there's different ways to resolve that.
Wow, that sounds crazy. Any other interesting...
Sure, you can get even more radical than that. Like chess with real time is just one rule added to chess. But Quadradius is a really, I think it's a spectacular game. And it's essentially taking checkers and giving each of the pieces random power. They're given random powers during the course of the game. And you get into an area of games. It feels very much like a paper game, but you couldn't really do it without the computer, and so it's a lot of fun to play.
And if I wanted to play Quadradius,
Quadradius.com probably. would be a good place to go. And
and you're saying that's worth people checking out if you
absolutely.
If you like any sort of turn-based strategy game, abstract strategy game, you should check out Quadradius.
Yeah. Also, Quadradius has something in it which I really see a dearth of in most computer games, which is that most computer games are so heavily skill based that the best players always win. I think there's probably more skill in StarCraft than there is in chess, in the sense that the better player will win more often. But with most paper games, there's enough luck involved, like poker, that anybody can win, but there's enough skill that if you play long enough, the you know you're going to get some payback on your skill. And Quadradius, you sit down and play that, anybody can win, but there's still a hell of a lot of skill in the game.
Well, and that there's an interesting possible reason for that is in paper games, your audience pool, your local audience pool is so much smaller that if paper games are going to survive, they're going to have to be able to be played with a relatively broad range of skills. And the internet and the computers have sort of freed that up a little bit in that, you can hop on and play a game of StarCraft and be matched against someone that's relatively close to you in rating because you've got a pool of tens or hundreds of thousands of people playing.
Do you guys find that player matching systems generally work well? Because I always hear the complaints, and I don't play enough stuff to know, but it always seems like there's always a problem that nobody's quite dialed in how to do it right.
And absolutely true, but it depends on what you're comparing it to. Like if you're comparing player matching system for StarCraft with just being matched against a completely random player, then you would see, wow, it really is doing something. It's doing a lot.
Right. My preferences would be to see more games that just are broader. But if you've got these intensely skill testing games, then you have to have some sort of matching.
So with respect to these game tweaks, is there anything, any other games that you've seen that have leveraged what works well in the online environment and taken the core mechanical elements of the board game and put them forward?
Yeah, it's always interesting to see a translation and see some small change which comes out naturally online, like Stratego. When you used to play Stratego, if I attacked your piece, we would both compare pieces and see which one won, and that was the way the game worked. Online or on the electronic version, suddenly it very naturally opens up this other possibility where the victor is determined, but the loser doesn't know what beat them, and that is a minor change, but it really changes the game in a very interesting way.
Yeah, I mean, and another thing is electronic battleship. I'm sure there's an online version, but there is anyway an electronic version where they sort of excise the heart and soul of Battleship in
Which
order
was?
Cheating.
That explains why I've never won a game of Battleship against you.
Listen, if they wanted to not have your pieces move, why don't they call it Maginot Line, right? I mean, they give you things with motors on them. Turn the motors on. That's all I got to say. But the electronic version for those people who don't like to be cheated is probably really good. It handles a lot of that sort of stuff.
Cheating in Battleship is actually it's almost condoned by the design in that besides just the IP, but because they give you those white counters to mark misses,
mm-hmm.
So you mark your misses. That has no relevance to me if I'm not cheating. If I'm cheating, it tells me where I can move my boats in order to not contradict the information. That's the only function the white pieces have.
You are correct, sir.
All right, no more Battleship with you. We played Cash Money Battleship. This is ridiculous. So, are there any games you'd like to see translated or brought into the digital world that you haven't seen?
Yeah, well, there's one poker variant which I really like to play that actually would be better online than in real life because it would eliminate some of the cheating and people do sometimes play for money. But it would also be a very fast version of poker to play online, and that's Guts. Probably it exists somewhere. It is the internet.
Well, let's just quickly go through what Guts is.
Guts is sort of simultaneous poker. Everyone gets a hand. It's usually three cards. There's various variations, but usually you get three cards. There's some rank order of hands, which is slightly different than regular poker. For instance, five of a kind is really not worth anything in a three card game. Anyway, you all decide whether you're going to fold or not. You make this decision in your head, and you go 1, 2, 3, shoot, and you either throw your hand down, which means you folded, or you don't do that, and you're in. And then if you're in, then you compare those hands to each other. The loser matches. The winner takes the pot. The loser has to match it, and you play until there's only one person stays in.
Yeah, this is a really natural version for computer because when you have a bunch of people taking turns online, as we've talked about earlier, it may move in some sense faster than around the table, but it's a lot less interesting because you're playing against people you don't know typically, and you're not having conversation go on. So if you can make the game simultaneous, that's really interesting. So any sort of simultaneous poker would be, I think, a real hit.
Yeah, most of my poker nights end with Guts, and I'm a Guts master. I'm a master at the 1 millisecond drop after everybody else drops.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, you know.
Yeah, the online version might take that away, too.
Yeah, it sucks.
I've cheated at everything, and I've never cheated at Guts.
So. Well, we should play some Guts and stop playing Battleship.
Yeah. And it really is. I cannot tell you how many poker nights that I'm, you know, down a dollar or two, and then the game of Guts at the end, and I walk home with 15
right, Guts,
or 20 bucks.
Guts tournament, you and me, next week. We'll tell you how it goes. So that's all the time we have. I'd like to thank everybody for tuning in. Once again, my name is Tyler Bielman on behalf of Scaff Elias.
Oh, that's me?
Yeah. Okay. And Richard Garfield.
And that's me.
And we'll talk to you all next time. Oh.